reminds me today, the specter of love that's gone away.
WRCT 88.3. My name's DJ Tony Tunes, and this has been From Here to Eternity. Before you just heard Lady Luck by Torn Boys, we also had Love You to Death and Promises You Made by Ethos Sign. I'd like to thank you all for joining me today. We'll see how this goes, doing it remote for a little while, but thanks again for joining. You have a wonderful rest of your week. Take care, and God bless.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. Welcome to Ebony Spectrum and In Black America for this week. First up, we have perspective from Professor Eddie Glaude Jr.
Well, it's an extraordinary moment in the history of the country where the kind of Cold War, the Cold Civil War, that has defined our politics. And, you know, we've used different kinds of language or descriptions of that Cold Civil War, you know, deep extreme partisanship and the like, deep political division. But the Cold Civil War became hot on January 6th. You know, Donald Trump declaring that if the persons, the people who attended the march, if they did not act, that they would lose their country. To see the battle flag of the Confederacy, marched around the Capitol, to see this mob of white voters. It was mixed with white Christian nationalist, white supremacist discourse, this kind of gaggle of grievance and fear and hatred mobilized to overturn an election, right? Gave the nation a sense of the fact, of the reality that we were standing on the precipice, that the deep divisions in the country were more than just simply disagreements, political disagreements, that they cut to the bone, actually through the bone, to the marrow of the bone. I was on television. I think I was talking with Christine Amanpour at the time it happened, and we were struck by the nature of the violence, by the response of the congressmen and women. You heard Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell condemn Trump, but within a matter of weeks, they began to retell the story. So historically, it represented this kind of, the Cold War became hot for a moment. But then, almost immediately, there was an effort to rewrite what happened, to disremember, to use Toni Morrison's language, you know. And here, 4 years later, this combination of active forgetting and, you know, willful lies or willful ignorance in this regard, right, has brought us to this moment where Trump is about to be inaugurated as the 47th president of the United States, which is just mind-blowing. Because, you know, the so-called forgotten American or the silent majority, they've never been forgotten or silent. They've always been loud and always have in so many ways impacted the direction, the trajectory of American politics, of policy decisions. In so many ways, what Nixon and others have been doing, what they did and are continuing to do, is to exploit this sense of grievance and fear that these people are somehow losing control over the country. So-called forgotten American in the face of demographic shifts in the country, the browning of America, somehow this country no longer belongs to you. What does that mean in its detail? In its detail, it means that these folk are really exercised over the fact that perhaps America will no longer be a white nation in the vein of old Europe. So what does it mean for the Democratic Party to pander to that? You know, Donald Trump says, he said at one point, that unlike President Abraham Lincoln, he would have compromised with the South. Now, I'm not obviously kind of equating the forgotten or silent majority with the Confederacy, but there's a linkage here. There's a connection here. But what would it mean to compromise with the South over the issue of slavery? What does that entail? Who would bear the burden of the compromise? So the Democratic Party has found itself since the mid-20th century, since the Black freedom struggle, in which, you know, Lyndon Johnson passes civil rights legislation and voting rights legislation and declares that he's lost the South for a generation. And we see all of these Southern Democrats migrate into the Republican Party. We see at one point, you know, those George Wallace Democrats, right, become, interestingly enough, Reagan Democrats. And we've witnessed over and over again Democratic leaders trying to, like a scorned lover, trying to get those particular white voters to return to the fold. And how have they done it? Well, if we think about the history of the Democratic Leadership Conference, the idea was to cozy up to Wall Street and Silicon Valley and distance the party from its traditional base. That's white, that's working class union folk and black folk. And so you get this triangulation, you get this reimagining of the Democratic Party to look like or and sound like Republican light. This is Bill Clinton. This is Al Gore. This is the Paul Begalas. This is the Jim Carvilles. These are the folk who are clamoring for the party to win back, right, those white working class voters that they themselves turned their backs on. This is fascinating, right? So I keep asking myself the question, what does it mean? What does it mean to try to curry favor with a constituency that believes that their life circumstance requires, right, the disavowal of issues that confront people of color, that confront women, that confront the LGBTQ plus community and the like? What does it mean to consent to that, to concede to that in a way? So I'm reluctant to concede to some of these folk who are talking about the Democratic Party changing course only to kowtow to that electorate that turned its attention to Donald Trump.
Now we have our friends from Native Land Podcasting.
A special and sad edition of Native Land Pod. I am your host, Angela Rye. Shout out to my hosts, Tiffany Cross and Andrew Gillum, in their absence today. But you all will be hearing from them, I'm sure, very soon on some solo pods. We're trying something new where we are going to do a side pod or a solo pod when there are issues that are pressing that we just want to get in front of you and make sure that we're in community with you talking about what's going on. So we are on YouTube Live, and I want to talk to you all about this memo that came from Matthew J. Vaith, the acting director of the Office of Management and Budget. Everyone is aware of this right now by the federal funding freeze. And let me tell you what's not frozen: your tax payments. They are still expecting your taxpayer dollars to fund these initiatives. And I want to go into just briefly what this funding freeze is calling for. And first, let me make sure my laptop is plugged in so I don't lose y'all along the way. Here's the thing. We should talk about what Donald Trump actually has the power to do and the power that Donald Trump is going to test during his presidency. We will talk about what is at stake with this potential funding freeze, what is being asked of different agency heads, cabinet secretaries and officials, et cetera. And we'll talk about the potential violation of the law. If there is time, we will get to a few other executive orders, which also may be of importance. I'm telling our producer, Lolo, I forgot to call her, so she should just make sure that she texts me just in case there's anything she wants to flag. So I first want to just mention that we will be doing these lives pretty regularly, at least every Tuesday. So you will hear from us on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday for sure. We're working through a Wednesday and Friday option as well. Now, this is the memo, okay? This is the memo we're looking at. This is from the the Executive Office of the President, Office of Management and Budget Control, Management and Budget. Here's what you all need to know. There is broad sweeping authority that OMB, that's what Office of Management and Budget has. In this memo, the acting director, because Donald Trump's nominee has not yet been confirmed by the Senate. The person who will be confirmed by the Senate most likely is a man named Russ Vought. And he is a prior OMB director. And it is very, very chilling. And let me tell you why. You know that podcast we did on what is Project 2025? And you know how a lot of folks were blowing off this whole idea of Project 2025? Well, the thing is real. And it was sworn in on Martin Luther King Day. And he is controlled by many parts. This is Stephen Miller's White House. Donald Trump is not running this thing. His deputy chief of staff for policy is. And you remember how Donald Trump tried to distance himself from Project 2025. And he even put out his own thing, the Agenda 47, right? Well, let me tell you something. Project 2025 is coming to fruition every single day. Russell Vought, who wrote the chapter about OMB and Project 2025, is who Donald Trump is seeking to confirm for OMB. Now, this is what I want to tell you that he says. On page 20, so you guys can fact check me, okay? On page 20 in Project 2025, they quote Russell Vought as saying, OMB should establish a reputation as the keeper of commander's intent. Yet OMB is dominated by career employees who often try to overrule political appointees serving in the various executive departments. Empowering political appointees across the administration is crucial to a president's success. Now, what does that have to do with this federal funding freeze today? Well, this is putting the power back into the hands of Donald Trump's political appointees. So this is how this memo starts, because a lot of you are reading the articles, but you aren't necessarily seeing what is in the actual document. So it's a short document. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there's a couple of points I want to share with you. It starts with the American people elected Donald J. Trump to be president of the United States and gave him a mandate to increase the impact of every federal taxpayer dollar. They go on to say that the federal government spends nearly $10 trillion $10 trillion in fiscal year 2024. And more than $3 trillion of that was for federal financial assistance, such as grants and loans. They go on to kind of demonstrate why the loan money, why the grant money that has been spent in this $3 trillion number should be reviewed. This is what they say that I think is important for you all to know. Financial assistance should be dedicated to advancing administration priorities, focusing taxpayer dollars to advance a stronger and safer America, eliminating the financial burden of inflation for citizens. I think we generally agree with that. Unleashing American energy and manufacturing. Let's talk about what they mean by unleash. There's an executive order for that, by the way. Ending wokeness. We don't even say that no more. But ending wokeness and the weaponization of government. You know what they mean by that. Read between the lines. Also read the executive orders that support that language. Promoting efficiency in government. That's that DOGE entity that Elon Musk is running. And making America healthy again, which is where they hope to put RFK Jr. So this is the thing. They go on to say the use of federal resources to advance Marxist equity. Now striving for equity, equality, and justice is a Marxist concept. Transgenderism and Green New Deal social engineering policies is a waste of taxpayer dollars that does not improve the day-to-day lives of those who we serve, they say. Now, y'all, they have mastered weaponizing our language against us. The Green New Deal is to preserve the planet for folks who look like me and you a little longer. The Green New Deal is about ensuring that Flint has clean drinking water. When they talk about transgenderism, we're talking about making sure that all humans have access to resources and the ability to survive, regardless of whatever identity you claim. And then Marxist equity, again, we're talking about the policies that began to really take root and take hold after George Floyd was murdered on camera for 9 minutes and 30 seconds. Many of us thought for the first time in our Black lives, our brown lives, our indigenous lives, or whatever lives, maybe your white lives too, that things were going to finally shift, that we were going to finally see justice served. And little did we know that it was a marketing ploy on behalf of many companies, including Target, that is now trying to dial back where George Floyd was killed. Imagine that. And entities, that, including those in the federal government, weren't going to push this for too long. And now they're trying to blame our focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion for why Democrats lost the election, because, you know, justice should not be served for the least of these. And here's what I take real issue with this particular executive memo. The people who will be hurt the most are the most vulnerable amongst us. They are the people who benefited greatly from a Trump check, right? From that stimulus payment, from a stimmy. They are the folks who thought that they would get a second chance in this administration because that check meant so much. I understand it. But now some of the things that you rely on every single day to keep your lights on are now in harm's way. So what they say in the next part of this memo is that each agency must complete a comprehensive analysis of all of their federal financial assistance programs. They're requiring a temporary pause on all activities related to obligation or disbursement of all federal financial assistance. That means they're not cutting no checks right now. It's a temporary pause that was effective as of yesterday at 5 p.m. I'm sorry, today at 5 p.m. And it is in effect until February 10th. So there may be things that you're waiting on. Maybe you were approved for a federal grant. Maybe you were approved for an SBA loan. Depending on the criteria of that grant or loan, you could be in harm's way. So that is what I want to flag for you. Lolo, text me if there are any questions that come up along the way. Now, the other thing that I think is highly dangerous is it says in the paragraph, this is the second page, this is the paragraph right above the bottom. It says that OMB may grant exceptions allowing federal agencies to issue new awards or take other actions on a case-by-case basis. What does that mean? That means that it is solely up to their discretion. That means that it is a super subjective standard. And the folks who rely on agency funding because they are one of a few, because they are a woman-owned business or a minority-owned business, or doing work that would impact Black maternal health, or some of the things, some of my most important work that I'm the most proud of on Capitol Hill was helping to advance centers of excellence at HBCUs when I worked for the wonderful Congressman Thompson on the Homeland Security Committee. That funding is now all at risk, right? There are centers of excellence in all types of industry and spaces and different interests. All of that is at risk. A lot of folks have been saying, we were just talking on our pre-production call before we started about whether or not SNAP benefits, those EBT cards that folks use to buy food at the stores and to keep groceries, you know, in their homes, whether or not school lunches for kids would be impacted, whether or not affordable housing would be impacted. Well, here's the thing. This memo is super vague, talking about Marxist equity and Green New Deal social engineering policies and all of that with intention. And some of you may be saying, well, how is this even legal, right? Like, the executive branch doesn't necessarily get to govern what is funded, because the United States House and the Congress, why is this? Oh, there it is. The United States House and Congress writ large has the obligation of controlling the purse strings. Let's go to why you all are saying that. In Article 1, Section 9, Clause 7, called the Appropriations Clause in the Constitution, states in pertinent part, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. Now, this is about governing what is contained in the United States Treasury. Nothing can be paid out of the Treasury, according to the Supreme Court, then, let's see if they hold it now, Nothing, no money can be paid out of the Treasury unless it has been appropriated by an act of Congress. Now, Donald Trump's administration is arguing something very interesting here. They are arguing that there may be a limitation on what can be spent. That is Congress's role. But that they can cut like there ain't no tomorrow under a doctrine that they call impoundment. So this means that they have control over cuts, but they don't have control of the spend of the purse strings. That is very, very dangerous. And it sounds like Donald Trump's administration is going to go hard to try to push this doctrine all the way to a court battle to the Supreme Court. Now, if this Supreme Court, the same one that decided that Donald Trump could not be civilly or criminally liable as a president, that he had civil and criminal immunity, sides with them on they can cut whatever they want as the executive branch, but they can't spend whatever they want. Y'all, we in danger. And that's what we really need to understand. This is a very, very serious memo. This current acting OMB director is pushing to broaden its authority and to ensure that the only people that can make these decisions about a federal spend are Donald Trump's political appointees. And here's what I think is scariest about this, you guys. None of this is surprising if you read Project 2025. We have got to stay informed. Y'all, we can't keep getting caught on our heels about what's to come because people are not informed. We have to be informed. Yes, it is a 922-page document. Yes, it is imperative that you read it. Yes, you need to know that many of the people who Donald Trump has put in critical roles, including Stephen Miller, which again, I would argue is running the White House from the immigration ICE raids to all of the attacks on DEI. All of that is Stephen Miller's brainchild. That's not Donald Trump's thoughts. That is Stephen Miller. And he had to have him back in the White House because there's no ability for Donald Trump to think this way without Stephen Miller. He basically has ceded his entire presidency to Stephen Miller. That is a very dangerous thing. If you look up who Stephen Miller is, you'll understand why. So here is the other piece of this. You will also note that when you thumb through Project 25 and you see who wrote these pieces, you're going to recognize some of the names. I challenge you all to take Project 2025, the document, just the table of contents, and who wrote each chapter, and compare those names to who Donald Trump has nominated for positions in his cabinet and has put into the White House to work for him. You all will see a surprising number of similarities. And if you can see those similarities, you can go into those chapters and see that the executive orders and actions that have come out of this administration so far are no surprise at all. So those are the kinds of things that we need to be paying attention to right now. If you all don't have questions about Project 2025 and this federal funding freeze, then I'll go on to another executive order. Okay, Lolo sent me this. How does this freeze impact state-level programs? Well, everything in every single agency is under review, from the United States Department of Agriculture, the Department of Energy, USAID, because they talked about a global spend as well, the State Department, which oversees USAID, the Department of Commerce. Y'all remember the Minority Business Development Agency was challenged on its merits just last year. Department of Treasury, every single governmental agency, SBA, for those of you who have small business administration loans that you may have just qualified for, at risk, the Department of Transportation. We have, you guys know, if you go into your airports at home, you're seeing a lot of construction. It is annoying, but we'll all be happy when it's done. There are these projects, these highways that are being built. Any DBE, disadvantaged business enterprise, that is working on those projects, that's all under review now, right? Depending on the grants and the loans that have been let. So everything is on the chopping block because of this very vague memo. And we need to be mindful of that. That is what is at stake. Somebody asked how this can be legal. I kind of just went through that. Hopefully what I've said makes sense. I will go through a little more just to backtrack a little bit on OMB. Some of you all might be like, I didn't get here in time. What is OMB? It's the Office of Management and Budget. Its responsibility is to prepare every year. Presidents introduce a budget. So you guys will see, if for those of you who work on the Hill, you see those huge binders. When I worked on the Hill, we used to divide up the sections and be responsible for a section and analyze the sections of the various sections of the president's budget. Well, they send this huge document over by agency, line by line, how much money they're going to fund the federal government. The OMB director is responsible for pulling that fiscal year budget together and dispersing it to the Hill for approval through the appropriations process. They also oversee the implementation of the president's priorities across the executive branch. And most of the time, what we say, what we've said on the Hill, is you can tell what the president's priorities are based on how they choose to fund the federal government. After we receive the budget, the Hill, Congress, the House is responsible for passing appropriations measures that has to be signed off or also passed in the Senate. Sometimes they don't agree, and so there has to be what was called a reconciliation process, and then the agencies are funded based on what is appropriated. Now, again, what I was saying earlier is they are challenging the president's authority to cut. I think they're acknowledging on the spend that that has to go through Congress. Again, be clear about the fact that most of Congress has bought into this president's agenda. So those of you who are like, well, it looks like SNAP benefits or the EBT cards might not be impacted, or kids' school lunches might not be impacted. What I would challenge you with is every single year, Republicans go after SNAP benefits. They try to cut them. I call the Congressional Black Caucus, and they are known to be the conscience of the Congress. Every year, that's a fight that they fight to ensure protection of those benefits. So that is what is at stake. And then you guys are asking what to do. The most important thing that I will give you right now is make sure you are reading. If we are reading ahead, I know it's stressful to be seeing all of these changes. You may have folks who've been impacted by the ICE raids. You may have folks who you know just qualified for a federal loan who you're like, I don't know if they're going to get to keep that money, or a grant, a research grant at a university, right? That is so scary. But we cannot bury ourselves in fear. We have to stay alert. And the most important way we can do that is by reading what's in front of us. Project 2025 been written. Heritage Foundation been on this for years and years and years. Go and look. When you see the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, and we hear about fiscal conservatism, that is what it is. It is about finding ways to cut corners so that they can ensure the rich keep their tax cuts, right? They don't ever have the money to increase minimum wage. They don't ever have the money to ensure that kids can have summer jobs. They don't ever have the money to ensure that centers of excellence are fully funded, or HBCUs and Hispanic serving institutions and the institutions, tribal colleges, ever have the money that they deserve. But they can always find that dollar for war and for tax cuts. And that's what we're up against right now. So I implore you to read Project 2025. I implore you to pay attention to these memos. Don't just take in the executive orders and actions that are coming out. Don't just take my word for it. Read it yourself. In the last paragraph of this memo, it talks about agencies having a responsibility to look into each financial assistance program in these three ways. Assign responsibility and oversight to a senior political appointee. Again, we know that that means that person thinks like Donald Trump. They are so concerned about career employees, federal government employees, that they haven't found you yet. I implore you to stay and make sure that you are serving the people as you know it is your obligation to do. You might not have had to take an oath, but we have to make sure that we keep people in place who will tell the truth about what this administration is doing. We need whistleblowers to talk about everything that is happening so that we can better prepare. The second thing it says is review currently pending federal financial assistance announcements to ensure administration priorities are addressed and subject to program statutory authority. Modify announcements, withdraw any announcements already published, and to the extent permissible by law, cancel awards already awarded if they are in conflict with this administration's priorities. Now, that may not be legal, but it first has to be challenged. So right now, what this says is the law of the land until it is challenged and until a federal court agrees with the more reasonable minds among us. And last, it says ensure adequate oversight of federal financial assistance programs, initiate investigations when warranted to identify underperforming recipients and address identified issues up to and including cancellation of awards. Y'all, they put us on notice. They put us on notice that as of 5 p.m. today, everything that the federal government funds that is under these very, you know, ridiculous buckets, you know, wokeness and trans, the words that they use to make the American people afraid, transgenderism, Marxist equity, everything that they can squeeze into these buckets, they will, and that is to create more funding capacity for the rich. So, people are asking about what the courts can do. Yes, this has to be challenged in court. And for the person that said it's just an audit, it is far more than an audit, my friend. These programs are being frozen. The funds are not going to go out. They say in here that they are trying to find if any programs that fit in those buckets that I've named, the wokeness, Marxist equity, transgenderism, Green New Deal, all of those are subject to cancellation. Why? Because they don't fit in with the current administration's priorities. That is the language and the framework that they will use to cancel the programs. So for those of you who work in the federal government, for those of you who have federal funding, I am suggesting that you figure out a way to ensure that your programs do not fall within that framework. So if you are advancing opportunities for the underserved, you better find some new language. If you are ensuring that the climate is safe and that climate change doesn't completely take us out, you better find some new language. These people ain't come to play, and they told us what they were going to do in a whole 922-page manual, so we got to get on it. Well, I've been on for 25 minutes. That went on pretty quickly, and that doesn't leave me any time to go through these executive orders. What I would urge you to do is make sure that you subscribe. This content will be just for subscribers soon, and then if you don't follow us on social media, make sure you do at Native Land Pod. Native Land Pod has information on other executive orders. We're going to keep you informed. As we get information, we'll share it. What we don't know, we'll tell you we don't know. Again, I don't know if SNAP or some of these housing programs will be impacted, but I promise you we'll be following it closely. We have your back. You all know within NLP, we say all the time, welcome home, and we mean that. This is your safe space. It's a safe space for us. We thank you for giving us that safe space. And what I can tell you is you are not alone. We are in this together, and we will get through it. Our people have experienced so much more difficulty in the past, and we don't want to go back. We know we don't want to go back. Many of us voted to not go back, but this is where we are now. We've got to accept where we are in order to change it. So let's get to work. Our first obligation is to stay informed, and whatever ideas you come up with, share them with us. We take videos for our shows every week. I would encourage you, if you have questions about the executive orders or this memo that came from OMB, send those in. Lolo takes them on DM at Native Land Pod. We'll get those videos. Tell us your name and where you're from. We'll get them uploaded for our show tomorrow that we record that drops on Thursday. Please, please, please stay in the loop with us. We want to hear from you. Our platform is yours too. And we can't wait to hear from you all. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for all of your questions. And please let me know if there's any other questions you have. I know we only got to one executive order. I'm sorry, but I have so much to say. And this was a new one. So there are others coming. If you guys want to keep hearing this content and keep engaging in this way, we will do that. So thank you so much for tuning in. Welcome home, y'all. We'll see you Thursday.
Since this program is being aired on Thursday morning, you can go check out Native Land Podcasting later on today and get more updates on exactly what is going on in the nation. Next up, we have more information about Marcus Garvey and what's going on there in Jamaica. The reason why I keep bringing up Marcus Garvey is because in the United States and on our local news stations, you are not hearing about the pardon of Marcus Garvey. This segment comes from TV Jamaica.
Me in the whirlwind or the storm, look for me all around you. The words of Jamaica's first national hero, Marcus Mosiah Garvey, a name back in the headlines after Sunday's posthumous pardon by former U.S. President Joe Biden. I'm Dion Jacks-Miller. You're watching All Angles. With us to talk about the significance of the pardon, or some might say lack thereof, we have with us senior lecturer in the Department of Cultural Studies at the University of the West Indies, as well as director of the Center for Reparations, Sonia Stanley Nayo, college orator at the Edna Mandy College of the Visual and Performing Arts, and storyteller Dr. Amina Blackwood Meeks, and president of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, Stephen Golding, writer and cultural commentator in the United States, Ashina Robinson, joins us via Zoom. Before we start discussion, first, this overview by Kemon White.
What I'll say is this, that while I think all of us are pleased with it and recognize it for, you know, positive for Garvey, some people will have a more technical point. This includes a number of Garveyites who were saying that what they want is a complete exoneration.
A resident of Marcus Garvey Way in St. Anne, reacting to news on Sunday that former President of the United States, Joe Biden, had issued a posthumous pardon for Jamaica's first national hero, Marcus Mosiah Garvey. The pardon came more than 100 years after his 1923 conviction and more than 70 years after his death in 1940. In a statement, Biden said that advocates and lawmakers had praised Garvey's global advocacy and impact. They also highlighted the injustice underlying his criminal conviction. He further noted that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. described Mr. Garvey as the first man of color in the history of the United States to lead and develop a mass movement. Garvey was convicted of mail fraud in the U.S. as president of the shipping and passenger company, the Black Star Line, for supposedly using the mail to defraud someone into buying stock in the company. He served a part of a 5-year prison term for then-U.S. President Calvin Coolidge commuted or reduced this sentence. He was deported to Jamaica in 1927. Mr. Garvey was a civil rights activist, journalist, and businessman who promoted Pan-Africanism, Black nationalism, and racial equality. He founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association, a group dedicated to uniting and empowering Black people globally. For years, supporters have called for him to be exonerated. They argued that Garvey was jailed because of his activism and skin color, and say the sentence was politically motivated. A pardon represents legal forgiveness. A commutation reduces the punishment but doesn't affect the conviction. An exoneration officially clears someone who had been convicted of a crime. Culture Minister Olivia Grange believes the pardon is not enough and says she will be pushing for Garvey's name to be fully cleared.
We will continue to work with the Garvey family, led by Dr. Julius Garvey, and all the other stakeholders, the Congressional Black Caucus, the UNIA, both political divide in this house, we'll be at one in this effort to push for the clearing of Marcus Garvey's name. And to remember, it's one aim, one destiny.
Dr. Angela Brownberg had this to say.
The conviction was the result of deliberate sabotage to provide a pretext, yes, for his conviction and deportation. Once the pardon recognizes that, we are clear in our mind that it is indeed for us an exoneration.
Back in St. Anne, Stephen Gordon says the pardon is a step in the right direction.
To know that the White House have finally seen it fit to follow up on what Coolidge did from in the 30s to finally free up Marcus Garvey's name politically. What this is going to do for all of Garvey's children psychologically going forward is going to be exponential. Only history could tell. So we feel very honored and privileged to be there, to be here on this day of all day when the media came, so we could broadcast our love for the Honorable Right Marcus Garvey.
Kemon White for all.
Thank you so much for that, Kemon. Aishina, I'm going to start with you. Tell me how you see this pardon.
Well, certainly, I think it's good news, right? It's something that has been called for a long time from quite a number of parties, particularly those who have been impacted by Marcus Garvey's teachings and his philosophy. But quite honestly, it's more symbolic than anything. It's a pardon, not an exoneration. But I think it really is evidence of Biden trying to put a pin on what part of his legacy, right? And part of that legacy has been to be seen as somewhat of a champion of racial justice, someone who wants to advance racial equity, who wants to be on the side of people of color, of Black communities. And so I believe putting that move out as part of a slew of pardons, as we all know that he gave at the end of his presidency, it's a symbolic attempt to put a tie on what his presidency has exhibited to a number of communities, and also to just show where he is philosophically. But moving forward, we have a new president, we have a new administration, and so the desires for further in terms of an exoneration, I don't know how far that may go, but I do think this was a symbolic gesture by former President Biden.
Okay, and Stephen Golding, you've said it's a symbolic, it's a gesture that you don't seem to think much of.
A cosmetic victory.
What do you mean?
I mean, we know Dr. Garvey has been pursuing this for a number of years and through a number of presidencies. He's 91 now. He's also aware of the fact that the move to get it through the Congress, which was started with Congressman Charles Rangel in 1987, was not getting anywhere. It fell off the table. But the group of congressional Democrats who lobbied Biden, led by Congresswoman Yvette Clark, have brought it back on the table at Congress. And I've heard her in interviews. She's aware that this is not the final step. I think what is important is the example that Jamaica laid down in 2018 when, by an act of parliament, we exonerated Mr. Garvey here, along with a number of our other national heroes who had been convicted of crimes during the colonial government period. I think that's an example of what the U.S. Congress needs to follow. I hear everybody talking about, we don't know about this presidency. Listen, presidents can only pardon. Interestingly enough, Donald Trump pardoned Jack Johnson, who was a contemporary of Marcus Garvey as the first Black heavyweight, and who they had charged with the Mann Act. Interestingly enough, before they charged Garvey for mail fraud, they had tried to charge him with the Mann Act also for traveling with Amy Jakes Garvey before they had gotten married. But it's no longer within the remit of the president. They can do nothing more. Presidents could never exonerate. You know, I'm still waiting to see what the pardon says. I saw Dr. Angela Brown talking about if the pardon admits that he was set up, then it's an exoneration to them. But legally, it's not. An exoneration means the U.S. justice system admits to doing a wrong, and then there are questions of reparations or maybe compensation that the family can bring up.
The statement that had come out from the White House on Sunday had said, advocates and lawmakers praise his global advocacy and impact and highlight the injustice underlying his criminal conviction. I mean, that's what we've seen so far. Sonia, standing now for you. You seem a little bit more impressed is probably the right word, but pleased with the pardon than Stephen.
I certainly think that it's a moment to rejoice, and it was a good day for Jamaica, for the United States, particularly for people of, you know, inclination in relation to Pan-Africanism, people who understand the legacy of Garvey and what it means for us, even in this time when we need to look for self-determination as something to achieve. So I'm happy that I've seen this in my lifetime. This has taken 100 years, right?
Why don't you see it as cosmetic, though?
I don't see it as cosmetic because it never had to be done. It could several presidents before. This is a moment when, under Biden, and I agree with the comments before, in an avalanche of pardons, we happen to have received the pardon for Marcus Garvey. And I think that's something to celebrate. It's not the end of the road for us. We do want exoneration. And that's an entire process that the legal minds will battle over. But for now, what we have is a pardon. And I think that for people of the inclination I'm talking about, the Pan-Africanists, the people who understand the legacy of Marcus Garvey in this time, it's important.
Amina, for you.
Clearly we celebrate. Clearly it's a step in the right direction. And clearly it is not the end of the road. I'd like to say this, Dion, that whether it's a pardon or an exoneration, it does not mean the same thing to all people. It does not mean the same thing to the African Americans as it means to the Africans. It does not mean the same thing to every single Jamaican. And it does not mean the same thing to the oppressors. It doesn't mean the same thing to people who don't understand why their blackness is important. It doesn't mean the same thing to people who don't understand what Garvey meant when he said that we who have built great civilizations will build another to astonish the world. And it does not mean the same things to those people who up until this point in time have been able to hide behind the facade that them really white. And all of a sudden Garvey come back to say, hello, that's not who you are at all. So for me, what this does is to present for us an opportunity to do many things. It's an opportunity to educate ourselves about what it means to have a legacy, about what it means to have a history and a heritage, and about how we treat the people who we say are the leaders in giving us this legacy, this history, and this heritage. And in grabbing hold of that opportunity, one of the questions we must honestly ask ourselves is, then where we that do all the time? Where we that do all the time? Let us say that Garvey is exonerated and we celebrate. What were we doing about those organs of the people who speak the voice of the people?
Well, I'll tell you what, hold a question for me. I know Aishina has to leave us shortly, so I want to go back to her. Because Aishina, one of the things, listening to everybody who has spoken, one of the questions that people keep asking me is, does Garvey mean anything to the younger generations? You know, it seems that everybody who is espousing his legacy and talking about the need to teach Garvey is, you know, 40 and 50 and 60 and 70 and 80 and 90. Do the younger generations care?
Well, I personally care. I don't know how young, if I can call myself the younger generation. I do care. Well, I agree with Dr. Blackwood that this is an opportunity for education around Garvey to be conveyed further, particularly in the United States where I am based, but for Black peoples around the world, right? This is a person who has influenced so many of our leaders, our civil rights thinkers and movers. But honestly, I think particularly in the United States, the education and the knowledge about Pan-Africanism, about the influences, about people like Garvey, about Garvey's philosophy, it's not as widely known as it should be. And in a moment right now when we have state legislatures across the United States passing laws that are limiting the teaching about history as it relates to race in particular, right, we see the connections between now there being a pardon for someone who did so much for Black people and the stories and the ways that he was fought back against by the state and by the system, right? And so for people to understand those connections and see how this has been done before and how these things can be repeated again, I think is really important. And I think this is an opportunity for that education to continue and for younger generations to understand the significance of Garvey.
Who leads that process? So where does that come from? Especially as you're saying, for instance, among the Black communities in the U.S.?
It has to happen within our own communities. It has to happen in our families, in our churches, around our kitchen tables. It has to happen with parents telling their stories to their children, you know, aunts and uncles and families having these conversations, sharing books, right? Sharing music. You know, Burning Spear has concept albums that are about Marcus Garvey. These storytellers exist in our society and the stories exist, but we have to make sure that they aren't lost, that they are continued to be passed on.
You know, I know you said the word story, and I mean, I immediately start to talk about because that is absolutely her wheelhouse. But do you see that education in the different forms? Because, for instance, people don't want to be preached at, you know? So it's a matter of how do we educate, but educate so that it's natural, it's fun, it's you know, interactive, not, you know, not like you're back at school watching somebody in this boring civic ceremony. Sorry, I have a thing for these boring civic ceremonies.
No.
How do we bring home Garvey in a way that's modern, that's contemporary, and that people see as relatable nowadays?
I believe we really, really lean on the values and the inspiration and the courage of figures like Garvey. It's not a story of being overcome or defeated at all. It's a story of being brave and courageous and innovative and thoughtful about where you see yourself and your people being able to go. I think that's a story that's really exciting and really dynamic for young people, right? When they see a lot of the barriers and a lot of the structures in our society that feel insurmountable. And the fact that 100 years later, Garvey's name is still being discussed, right? His legacy is still being respected and honored and being fought for by people at the highest levels, right? And so I believe it's really narrowing down on what are the inspirational factors of the stories, what are the qualities and the values of these figures that we admire that we can find in ourselves, what are the stories or the issues that they are fighting against that we may still want to be showing up against today, right? It's showing those connections between what has happened before and what is possible today, and making sure people feel inspired that they have the energy and the ability to do that themselves.
And just before you leave us, I mean, you know how divisive the U.S. politics has become. Do you really think there's still any hope of exoneration?
Not with this administration. I believe it's a non-starter, right? You know, President Trump has already issued a number of executive orders, quite a few of them having to do with matters of race, diversity, equity, and inclusion. You know, Biden in his, you know, in his pardon talked about how, you know, Garvey was the first, one of the first people of color to do what he did and to manifest, you know, that encouragement and that gathering of people who really believed in his philosophy and his what he fought for. I don't believe it's possible under this administration, but I believe the work that has continued over the years can still continue because nothing lasts forever.
Going to give Trump a hard time. Let me remind the world, it was President Trump who pardoned Jack Johnson posthumously, 2018. And again, it lies with the Congress. There's no other path through the U.S. presidency since Biden has given this full pardon. Remember, Garvey wrote...
Can you see anything in this Congress that suggests amenity to pardon?
I know it's going to be difficult, but it's not within Trump's domain, you know? And also recall, you know, that Marcus Garvey sought his own pardon and got it in 1927 using his own political leverage with Calvin Coolidge. There's so much behind that.
What though in 2025?
I am saying that let's not focus on Trump. It has to do with how the Congress people are able to put it on the table, to gather support, to take a vote, to get an exoneration. Presidents cannot exonerate.
Yeah, but when I said divisive politics, I also meant the Congress. But I have to leave it there. Aishina, always so good to see you and talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take the break and continue with our guests in studio in just a moment.
Thank you, All Angles from Television Jamaica, and we thank you for listening today. Marcus Garvey influenced a lot of folks, Malcolm X, Dr. King, and Burning Spear. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Can't get no food to eat. Can't get no money to spend. Whoa. Can't get no food to eat. with you. Hello. Shall be spanked with many stripes, weeping and wailing and mourning. You've got yourself to blame. I tell you, the right, 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 the right. I beg you.
It's Friday, so I'm gonna keep it black, but I'm gonna keep it brief. These people are not my. Now that that's settled, there's a lot to recap and recount that I won't. If you expect me to have some sort of master plan, I don't. But just because they are up there carrying on Project 2025 as we told you they would, raining down oppressive statute after oppressive statute, strategy is not lost on us. I told y'all a long time ago, danger is real, but fear is not. And I'm going to encourage you not to let fear distract you in this moment. The seemingly relentless, very fast shift in power is designed to present a brute show of force with a menacingly imperious and impervious level of propaganda. And that's great, actually. That means we know what time it is. We feel what we do not understand, right? So never forget that you actually understand exactly what's going on here, so just do not engage. Fear-mongering and rage-baiting will become routine, online and in person. So if there was ever a time to shut our asses up, it's now. Now, I'm not telling you to allow yourself to be silenced or intimidated into submission. I'm telling you to sit back, learn, and move in silence. My granddaddy used to say, you let somebody talk long enough, they'll tell you everything you need to know. But we need not show our hand. Now, that's not to say we can go on living our daily lives unaffected by this tragic upheaval. Because 92% of all you want, this is not just going to affect the brown people and the gays, as if brown and gay was mutually exclusive from black. But even if it was, as a 92% of myself, let me tell you what would apply to you regardless. These anti-immigration laws, hate to tell you and I hope I don't sound ridiculous, but they don't just concern the people you see cleaning up your hallways or doing construction work on the side of the road. This man is also trying to undo birthright citizenship, which was a part of the 14th Amendment, established so that African Americans could be recognized as full citizens. And if he were to put a stop to that after February 19th, that would mean an end to the whole first generation born American deal that's become part of the fabric of so many Nigerian, Jamaican, Haitian, and other black family dynamics across the diaspora. He's gunning for your insulin. And these days, that doesn't just mean grandma's insulin, because next to American Indians and Alaskan Natives, non-Hispanic black adults have the second highest prevalence of diagnosed diabetes in the United States. So while he hasn't removed the $35 cap yet, because that's a law and there has to be a process, don't forget that not only did he win the presidency, but the House and Senate have a Republican majority as well. In his efforts to forge a society that is colorblind and merit-based, he sounded off in his first state with an order to end radical and wasteful government DEI programs and preferencing to eradicate all DEI programs, departments, and budgets federally. And then there's the executive order to reverse Lyndon B. Johnson's executive order from 1965. Now, what he might not know is that the Equal Employment Opportunity Act itself cannot be revoked because it, too, is a law that was enacted by a former president. But these people are already trying to supersede states' rights, so who knows what could happen down the road. Now, most of these things will affect federal workers first, because that's all he legally has control of. They are already sending emails telling people they got 10 days to suss out DEI contractors and report them, because according to his administration, we already got the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and anything else on top of that is unconstitutional and just reverse racism. These people are constantly twisting and misrepresenting factual information, not just to reach their own political aims or to cover up America's misgivings, but to also perpetuate the longstanding idea that black people cannot handle freedom, that we have either mismanaged it, taken advantage of it, or that in our hands is simply dangerous. And to that I say, you're right, because the freedom that you speak of, the only kind of freedom that has ever been awarded to us, has only ever been a version of it, an abbreviation, a quasi-freedom meted by whatever measure of privilege is deemed expendable at the time. Because at every opportunity for progress, whiteness does not hold itself accountable for its wrongdoing. Instead, it inflates itself by taking credit for the progress that was made in spite of it, because it for damn sure wasn't made on behalf of it. And then it says, well, how much privilege am I willing to give this time? Because I still got to maintain order, and somehow they always still want more. You damn Skippy. So they get chaotic when we start to make our dollar out of 15 cents. They start scrambling when we turn the world upside down with our 15 minutes of fame. And if you haven't noticed, it's not just a battle between white and black, between good and evil, but a game of call and response. And it's what we do with our taste of freedom that never fails to send them into a frenzy. And I don't know how many people of faith we got in the audience today, but one thing about my God is he does his best work in times of chaos. Hey! Woo! Because yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of what? Hey! Oh, he prepares a table before me when? In the presence of who? Oh, okay. But alas, faith without works is dead. And in the face of all this, it's time for you to tap into community. That means to engage in community relief efforts. Educate yourself on community resources. Be more open to the people who look like you and let go of the individualism that is set up to leave us weak and vulnerable. And while you're at it, shut up about it. Why? Because the revolution will not be televised and it won't be on social media.
What kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
What if the second deadliest cancer in men and women could be prevented? Would you try to avoid the pain? And what if you could protect yourself without leaving your home? Colorectal cancer is highly preventable. Screening is important, safe, and most...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
2 hours ago, colleagues, I asked Mr. Kennedy to reconcile his many anti-vaccine statements with his handful of pro-vaccine statements. Instead, he gave us a word salad and ducked the issue.
During a confirmation hearing Wednesday, Senate Democrats grilled Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Trump's pick to head the Department of Health and Human Services. We'll speak to Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee, about Kennedy. Also, today's confirmation hearing for Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's pick to be Director of National Intelligence, as well as the Trump administration's shocking reversal under enormous pressure to freeze all federal grants and loans. Plus, we get the latest from Washington after an American airline carrying 64 people collided with an Army helicopter near Reagan National Airport. No one is believed to have survived. Then to Gaza, where Hamas has released 8 more hostages. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Rescue workers in Washington, D.C. have launched a massive search operation in the Potomac after an American Airlines flight and a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter collided midair late Wednesday, with both aircrafts crashing into the river. So far, no survivors have been found. At least 30 bodies have been pulled from the river. American Airlines Flight 5342 had 60 passengers and 4 crew members on board and was en route to the D.C. area, Reagan National Airport, from Wichita, Kansas. Several passengers were members of U.S. figure skating who are heading home after a training camp and the Nationals. The Black Hawk helicopter had 3 soldiers on board conducting a training flight. An investigation is underway by the National Transportation Safety Board, aided by the Federal Aviation Administration. On social media, President Trump called the crash, quote, a bad situation that looks like it should have been prevented, unquote. Just 1 week prior to Wednesday's deadly crash, Trump fired the head of the Transportation Security Administration and all members of the Aviation Security Advisory Committee. The crash comes just days after the head of the Federal Aviation Administration, Mike Whitaker, stepped down. FAA administrators usually serve 5-year terms. Trump has not named a replacement. Whitaker announced his planned departure in December after Elon Musk repeatedly attacked him on social media, tweeting he needs to resign. The White House Wednesday rescinded a memo from the Office of Management and Budget that briefly froze trillions of dollars of federal grants and loans, even though the money had already been appropriated by Congress. The order set off panic and mass confusion across the federal bureaucracy, briefly disrupting funding for Medicaid, housing, and other public services Tuesday before a federal judge put a temporary hold on the plan. On Wednesday, a second federal judge, U.S. District Judge Jack McConnell in Rhode Island, signaled he, too, would block the Trump administration from withholding federal disbursements, writing, quote, "I am very concerned about the irreparable harm which has clearly been put forth," he said. On Wednesday, Press Secretary